Hello, I'm Holly Gibbs with the Global News Podcast, and I'm making my way to the Palais de Congrès in Montreal, Canada, for this special edition. Normally, we have the privilege of hearing from some of the most powerful leaders in the world, but in the next half an hour, we'll be doing something different.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service.
I'm just going through the revolving doors to attend the One Young World Summit. It's a gathering of young people from more than 190 countries, all with extraordinary stories, suggestions, and solutions to the world's biggest problems. Their ambition is to become the leaders of the future. In front of a live audience, I will be joined by four fellow youngsters who'll be taking questions from our BBC correspondents around the world. Let's go on stage and meet them.
My name is Farkhana Mutaj. I'm an Afghan-Canadian professional soccer player. I am the captain of the Afghanistan women's national team. As many of you may be aware, the Taliban has gained control of Afghanistan and has banned women's sport participation. So aside from that, what I'm trying to do is lobby for the return of women's football. And as I do that, I'm actually also a co-founder of a nonprofit organization where we use sport to help ease the settlement of refugees to Canada. So I use sport as a catalyst for change.
Next to Farkhunda, we have 25-year-old Justin Langham from the rural Canadian town of Swan River.
Panche, Kiowau. It's a pleasure to be here. What matters the most to me as a Métis youth myself is advancing Indigenous youth prosperity, not just here in Turtle Island, but globally.
Now on my right, we have Sarah, who is 30 years old and has traveled here from Indonesia.
My work is to get people excited about nature, to get people care about nature, and find out the best way how to can protect nature. You could find me in the forest looking for animals, or in a swamp, mangrove, deep in the remote areas of Indonesia.
And last but not least, we have 26-year-old Aram Ishtiak from Pakistan.
The thing that I particularly focus on is trying to use technology, particularly AI, to scale and sustain impact, specifically for marginalized communities, including hearing impaired individuals, and trying to further that by the means of mobile technologies and AI.
And that's our lovely panel. Let's start by diving into the world of AI.
Hi, I'm Zoe Kleinman. I'm the BBC's technology editor. Are you concerned about the environmental price tag of the hardware which powers artificial intelligence? And what would you like to see done about it?
Aram, I think it's a good place to start with you.
I think coming from the perspective of developing AI technology in a developing nation, I have had sort of the privilege of being very resource constrained, where we don't have access to the hardware that people in the first world nation do. And that had led us to focus on AI development with a strong focus on efficiency, with a strong focus on making sure that the systems that we create don't end up necessarily requiring a lot of resources from the planet in terms of electricity, in terms of natural resources. And I think the developed nations can certainly take sort of a lesson out of this playbook, where the focus doesn't necessarily have to be how big you can go, but rather how much you can impact with as little as possible.
And with your work in AI, have you seen any examples where AI has helped situations where climate change has taken over?
There are actually lots of situations, from actually being able to predict weather patterns, not just 7 days or 30 days into the future, but actually across a whole year, to even coming down to predicting air quality across a region and trying to understand what the makeup of that is and how can we better combat that, to even understanding something as small as the systems in a car relying on either electric or diesel or petroleum or gas to a degree where that ends up with the least possible amounts of emissions. And even with an example of like Google Maps, they use AI to ensure that the route they suggest you when you drive has the least possible carbon footprint. So there are like a wide variety of examples that are out there where AI is being used, if not completely solved for climate change, at least alleviate some of the impacts that are sort of caused by human-made actions.
Yeah, can I actually add on from the environmentalist perspective? I think with the hardware AI technology and its minerals like copper, so as we go more efficient of the resources, it can decrease the pressure also for mining of such like copper that is being used in the hardware of the AI technology. And I think regarding to hardware, the more we use the hardware, we also produce more electronic waste. And electronic waste these days become one of the fastest growing waste globally. But the fact is that it's less than 20% that electronic waste is being collected and recycled every year. So I think in regards to hardware AI technology and also the environmental price tag, we kind of also need to think about the life cycles of exactly the resources that being used for that technology.
Do you also think that AI is something that we all just need to accept is going to be a big thing? And perhaps now we should just start looking at ways to make it efficient?
I think we're at sort of a transition point where AI has become so well integrated into the products that we use on a daily basis. And again, from Google Maps to ChatGPT to even other things like when you apply for a job to a workplace, the system the human resource department uses also leverages some AI to help better sort out resumes. So we do already live in an AI world. I think the sort of question now is, to what degree are these systems capable and reasonable and unbiased enough to be deployed widely across a diverse spectrum of individuals? Are we making sure that these systems don't end up producing results that may be racist, that may be sexist, and they represent the reality of our world, the diversity, the variation that currently exists in our world, and continue to do so?
We're going to stick with technology here and go to our second question.
I'm Mark Easton. I'm the BBC's home editor. Social media is blamed for spreading dangerous misinformation and providing a platform for hate crime. Should governments ban some apps?
Farkunda, could we start with you?
Social media is really a double-edged sword. On one hand, it is a platform for good, for us to be able to share the incredible work that we're doing, maximize our impact. But on the other hand, it can also be used to harm individuals for hate speech. And that hate speech and misinformation actually travels at the speed of light before we even know it. So just to give you an example, in 2021, YouTube had reported and removed over 6.6 billion hate messages. And that's just within 1 year. And now when we consider it, YouTube is a platform, unlike Instagram, that people constantly comment on. So that should give you the impact, or should let you know or be aware of how it can be maximized negatively. But conversely, it is a site that we can leverage for positive impact. And so I would not ban social media, and the reason being because it takes away from all the positive that we can attract, regardless of the negative that exists out there. And something I do want to mention about the negative of social media, and then I'll come back to the positive, is that this summer in the UK, we actually saw how quickly misinformation spread. And that was when riots sparked because a suspect of stabbing three young girls seemed to be spread incorrectly that it was a Muslim asylum seeker. And what ended up happening was mosques were raided, local shops were looted, and it was mayhem. So that is the negative side. But alternatively, there were counter riots that actually stood up and used their platforms to advocate for anti-racism and misinformation. Now, with regards to banning, I wouldn't, because that would be censorship and that would take away from free speech and what we can use in a very impactful light. But I would really reinforce regulating that and making sure that we are constantly ensuring that there are community guidelines and that that is being audited continuously. Because if there is something that is perpetuating hate, we want to make sure that we can tackle it right from the beginning.
Justin, I wonder if I can bring you in on this. Do you think, to Farkunda's point, not necessarily ban, but regulate? And how can we hold social media companies to account?
Yes, so I think it's, you know, crucial not to ban any social media platform. Obviously, the incitement of hate that is legal here in Canada, you know, that's something that as a Canadian, I'm aware of. But when we talk about banning social media and banning the speech of those who have opinions that might be radical to us, we have to think about the counterpoint of sending them away, sending them those who have conspiracies that the government is against them, that their voices are being quieted. What will happen to those people? They'll be sent underground. And that sort of idea of the government is evil, that free speech is being under attack, will fester and grow further. That's what we've been seeing in the US for the past few years. So I certainly think that the government has the ability to restrict and also limit the amount of speech of certain creators while ensuring that those with radical ideas without the incitement of hate are able to express that, because that's part of democracy.
Aram, I wonder if you could comment on this. Do you think that this is a use for AI?
I think, again, this is for the responsible use of AI. A lot of these platforms, and echoing both Farhanda's and Justin's point, banning them is certainly not the solution. Appropriately regulating them is. But even beyond regulating these platforms directly, it is the AI tools that they use that need even stronger regulation. We have seen cases where these systems basically run rampant and use data that wasn't necessary theirs, or use publicly available data from people that haven't really consented to it. So while sort of regulating would make these companies more responsible about the content that's on their platforms and making sure that there's no sort of divisive or hateful content on there, how they solve it scalably through AI also very specifically needs to be regulated and made sure that the systems that they create are based on technology that is ethical, based on technology that focuses on consent, and generally just responsible use of AI that they need to focus on.
Let's move on to the current state of affairs across the world with our next question.
Greetings, world leaders. My name is Lise Doucette. I'm a Canadian journalist and the BBC's chief international correspondent. How will you address the jarring political reality that the world's top table, the UN Security Council, still reflects the shape of the world in 1945 when it was established, rather than the world of 2025?
Justin, I wonder if we can start with you.
I think we all know the UN Security Council's system reflects a world that does not exist anymore. We live in a rapidly changing world, one in which, you know, our own governments right now, who are set in 2024, are challenged to keep up with. So I think in the effort of inclusivity, there are many ways in which the UN can, you know, break free from the constraints and the facade that it is a useless organization. You know, what can it do? We see conflict all around the world, yet this organization that was created to stop that conflict and create peace has no say. And I think it's because set in the past, we do not have people at the table. And it's not just about expansion. It's about changing the power dynamics within the UN, within the UN Security Council. And that's by having people from the communities and the states that are actively, you know, being compounded by climate change, by conflict. We do not have representation from the global south. We do not have representation of indigenous peoples. We do not have representation of many minority states and many minority groups. And I think, you know, it's not just about inclusivity. It's about understanding that peace can only come about when we're all at the table, but when we're all at the table together and have the same power and voice as everyone else. And only then can the UN be seen as something worth existing.
What steps would you take to start that diversification?
So this weekend, you know, it's the UN Summit of the Future. The UN has always been, at least for the past few years now, very inclusive of youth voices. But I've noticed, you know, I've been to some of these events, that a lot of the voices fall on deaf ears. We are talking to an institution that's been entrenched since 1945, yet they seem on the surface to be in the future, yet within the system itself, they're ingrained in a past that is forgotten, that is created conflict that we're seeing right now in Palestine. And that's, you know, what we need to look at. within the UN.
Fakinda, what are your thoughts?
I certainly echo a lot of Justin's sentiments, so thank you for those powerful words. Just to provide some context here, so the UN Security Council was developed in 1945 after World War II. Now, what that means is those powers at the time, which was US, UK, France, Russia, and China, they are the permanent members. But we see to this day, there are other nations that are stepping up in order to avoid conflict, in order to support peace. And I would argue that they have a heavier load that they are taking on, and they're actually doing a phenomenal job at it. So it's about inviting those voices to the table and sharing how they're maintaining world peace. Aside from that, I agree with Justin as well, right? The credibility of the UN is on the line if they're not willing to change as the world changes. A month ago, I was actually in Rwanda, and I visited the Kigali Memorial, the genocide memorial, and it was absolutely heartbreaking. But in that memorial as well, aside from the horrific things that happened within Rwanda, they shared other genocides, such as the Bosnia genocide, the Holocaust, and so on. So what is it that we are doing to make sure that this does not continuously happen? Peace is not about memorizing facts about what happened in the past and memorizing statistics about how many people were unjustly killed. It's about learning about what happened in the past and ensuring that that does not happen in the future. And I think we all genuinely have a role to play, and we should hold institutions like this accountable.
You're listening to a special edition of the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service at the One Young World Summit in Montreal, Canada. We're joined at the summit by people from 190 countries. But have they ever thought about going beyond and into space?
Hi, I'm Palab Ghosh, and I'm one of the BBC's science correspondents. I'd like to ask you whether we should focus humanity's resources on combating climate change or sending people to the moon, Mars and beyond. Or should we do both, one endeavour helping the other and raising the human spirit?
Shara, let's start with you.
I like the questions. I think when I read the news of wealthy men want to go to the moon, I was thinking, oh, if I have a lot of money, should I also go to the moon or should I go to the Mars? But back to the questions, I think space explorations allow us to realize how fragile our Earth is in the dark, dark, vast universe, and how we ourselves, we only have each other to take care of each other and take care of this tiny, tiny, fragile Earth. So as a child, I was astounded by it. So if space exploration allow us to raise the human spirits, to advance science that can benefit our society, to really revolutionize the way we think, I think we should continue space explorations. But what goes wrong is that when space explorations become the race of ego, and it also goes to, I think, a deeper philosophical question is that what's our priority as a humankind? It goes to how about the money that we spend on war? How about the money that we spend on deep sea explorations? So I hope that this conversation is something that we continue to have, to think and reflect what actually matters to us. And then we can pursue the path of morality that speaks dearly to our heart and to the planet.
Justin, I wonder if I come to you next.
So I believe we need to prioritize our humanity and where we are on Earth. Because every time I see Elon Musk send another spaceship into space, I just want to scream. Because as we've heard over the past few days here, our Earth is literally on fire. And we have a responsibility to our home, to safeguard it. And, you know, I look back to this ancient Haudenosaunee teaching of the seven generations principle. And that principle is about living in a world and doing things in your community that reflect the positivity of seven generations ahead. And when you're in that community and when you're going through life, you want to leave a world that has clean air, water, and a livable world. And I think, you know, as an Indigenous person, I hold those teachings close to me. And as, you know, an advocate on behalf of not just my community, but as a global citizen, I want to share that message with others to help safeguard our world, our community, our states. And certainly, you know, I love space. I think space exploration is incredible to behold. Yet, I do believe we need to prioritize where we are on Earth. This is the only Earth we have. And I think we all know that. You know, we see it printed on t-shirts, on tote bags, everything. But do we truly recognize that once we go, we can't come back? This is what we have. This is our one young world.
Back down to Earth now, and we are going to look back at climate change with our next question.
I'm Samir Hussein, and I'm the BBC's South Asia correspondent. My question has to do with air quality. That has become a massive issue in India. What is it that you would suggest to try and combat air quality issues for this region?
Aram.
Apart from the mention of India in that question, I come from Pakistan, which happens to be the exact same region, and we face similar problems as well. But one place where I know for a fact that we lack is the ability to measure these problems. In Pakistan, it's very data dark in the sense that we can't improve what we can't measure. And things like air quality, pollution, fumes and exhaust from cars, vehicles, and all other industries, we haven't done a good enough job to actually hold these institutions, to hold these manufacturers, to hold these producers accountable in the sort of level of contribution they have towards air pollution. So in terms of how I look at this problem, at least in the region that I'm from, it more so is that we have to become very vigilant about measuring this and making everyone accountable, making everyone basically be at a degree where they know exactly how much they've contributed to the problem so that we can ensure that they're able to pay sort of reparations, basically what carbon credits currently do. But unfortunately, there's no formal system like that in Pakistan. So sort of formalizing that, ensuring that we have right monitoring and evaluation systems in place, that would be sort of a really good first step in that particular region.
How do you suggest that we start holding companies to account? What type of measures do you suggest that we put in place?
Fortunately, we've seen that companies respond to a very singular language, and that is the language of capitalism. As long as there's revenue coming in, as long as the profits continue to climb, the companies will continue, and they're reasonably incentivized to continue with their habits, to continue, you know, sort of ruining the earth. But what sort of really gives me hope, what gets me enthusiastic and excited, is to see over the last couple of years through social media, young people have really galvanized a lot of boycott movements, whether those are related to social justice issues, whether that's related to climate change. So we see that this sort of social activism has also translated into hurting the bottom line for companies that do the most damage. So I feel really positive about the fact that these sort of initiatives and this sort of social activism really leads to companies to think twice about what they're going to do to Earth and possibly the backlash that they might receive, especially from people our age, and how that might potentially affect their bottom lines.
That's an interesting point you made there about boycotts. Sarah, I saw you nodding your head a lot through that.
Yes, because it reminds me of Jakarta, Holly. I'm not trying to compete with India or Pakistan, but last year Jakarta was declared as one of the most polluted city in the world. And then at that time, I remember I flew to Jakarta and I could see that the entire city was just covered by pollutions, thick cloud, the skyscraper, I barely see it. And then when I arrived, I couldn't see the blue sky or even the sun, even though we are a tropical country, Holly. So it was that situation. And I also see my friends in Jakarta who just uploaded on their Instagram of the air quality. Ah, this is unhealthy. This is not a livable city. And then they keep like updating it every day. And then for Jakarta itself, the most contributing sector for the pollution was actually transport. So in Jakarta, if you can imagine, We have 11 million people, and the motorcycle is 18 million, and then the car is 4 million. So I think the best solutions will be to improving the public transportations like the bus line and also the train. I'm also thinking that it's probably cool if content creator or like social media influencer doing a content that it is cool, you know, to use train to your work, kind of to encourage young people to use more public transportations. So this kind of just a bit of ideas.
Moving on to our final question. We said we wanted to have a discussion about what would be different if young people were in charge. But that starts with getting people engaged with the politics around us.
I'm Rob Watson, the BBC World Service UK politics correspondent. A recent survey by the polling company Ipsos across seven countries, the UK, France, Italy, Sweden, Poland, Croatia and the US, found approximately 50% of people were dissatisfied with the way democracy was working in their countries and that many didn't believe their views were represented. How do leaders get ordinary people engaged with politics and to believe that they can make a difference?
I'd like to hear from you all on this one. Farkinder, let's start with you.
Absolutely. It's a fantastic question. So in case some of us are unaware, in the last Canadian federal elections, approximately 40% of our citizens didn't even vote. And that's astonishing because they're not voting on decisions that will directly impact them and our nation. But the reason being for many individuals is, why should they even put their trust in these politicians? What do these politicians have to offer? And how is it going to positively impact them in any way? And if they don't feel relatable, and if they don't feel like there is something that they and their communities will be able to benefit from, they're not going to put their reliance or trust on these individuals. And so from a politician's point of view, what I can say is, I'm not a politician, but what I could suggest is that they have to be transparent, honest, and hold themselves accountable. And so every time there is an election, for instance, politicians set some goals and deliverables. And when that's not achieved, they need to hold themselves accountable and share with the public why that is. They can no longer scapegoat citizens and blame it on immigration or refugees and the job market is as a result of an influx of newcomers coming in and stealing jobs, because that's when misinformation continues to rise, hatred and racism. The most important thing is build that trust, but the best way to build that trust is to hold yourself accountable and share how you can use your platform to actually support those. And as human beings as well, we're individuals that are wired on instant gratification. So as a politician, what can you do today that will impact someone tomorrow?
Justin.
So I have the pleasure of being part of a parliamentary internship program in Ottawa this year, and I'm very proud to be part of this cohort because I have an up-close and personal view with members of parliament on all sides who have shown me a new side to the political system. And I also had the pleasure today to listen to Prime Minister Trudeau. And, you know, I love Justin. He has the same name as me, right? But what I've heard was the same talking points, the same deflection to provincial, then provincial to federal, and let's blame the other guy, and this neighbor is your enemy. And, you know, I think people understand that. I come from a small rural town in the prairies, and I live in an urban city now. You know, I've seen all sides. You know, I grew up amongst farmers, amongst every type of person you could really think of at any sort of political spectrum. And what I've noticed is when politicians listen actively and genuinely listen, only then will people be able to understand that their voices actually matter. And when they showcase their voices to a politician, we want to see that reciprocated. We want to see that we're not just shouting at a wall. And when it's time to cast our ballot, we want to be ensured that our vote matters. And every 4 years in the US, we hear the same conversations. And, you know, is this the best we can do? as a country? Is this the best we have in our democracy? And I think it's only when people in our community uplift one another, in every community, from coast to coast, it doesn't matter where you come from, but it does matter how you show where you come from and how you showcase your community, where you were raised, and utilize that as a passion for you to uplift others. Only then can we actively engage in democracy and actively get people out there voting and affecting change.
Sarah, to you.
For me, like simple things in Indonesia is to create a safe civic space to convey our opinions. Unfortunately, even right now, if we post something on social media and it can upset the government, you could get into jail. Like environmental journalists having a hard time to really convey the reality on the grounds. And it's very scary. Like, I don't want to be engaged in politics in situations where I don't feel safe, that I don't feel listened to. And yeah, I think the leaders really need to create and ensure that safe civic space that can ensure our freedom of speech, because that's the start of democracy.
Aram, your thoughts?
I have a bit more of a positive spin on this. We heard that 50% are dissatisfied. I'm also going to say that 50% are satisfied. It's unfortunate that it's the sensational headlines that oftentimes end up at the top of our feeds. It's the negativity that we're most attracted to, that we're most curious about, right? So we don't end up, or we only end up finding or seeing stuff about politicians that lied to us, that incited hate, that blamed everything on immigrants and refugees and all of those things. And I'm not denying that that doesn't exist. I feel the gap that exists is not necessarily only for these politicians to become better, but there are already a lot of advocates and politicians already in government. We've seen at the One Young World Summit, we've seen across this panel, there are people already doing the work that you and I and like all of us really feel close to, really feel passionate about. The only unfortunate thing is we don't see it across our social media feeds. We don't see it online. So for me, this problem, while politicians definitely have to do better, I think we can also do a better job of signal boosting and highlighting the great work that you see people around you doing, right? Farhan is doing amazing work. Justin is doing amazing work. Sarah is doing amazing work. And they're here. They're talking about their work, right? And people hearing this will feel really inspired. People hearing this won't necessarily think it is all doom and gloom. They will finally have some hope that, well, while the sort of worst of the bunch we've seen on all sorts of media may rile us up, may make us feel like it's never going to get better, but there are people out there spending day and nights, their blood, sweat and tears, spending their youth towards solving problems that we for a while thought that nothing could be done about. So there's definitely hope in that. So if anyone hearing this ever gets the opportunity to find someone that they feel really inspired by, I think it's up to us to signal boost them. I think it's up to us to make sure that the world knows about them, so that that 50% of dissatisfaction goes down to 49, 48, 47, and then slowly goes down to zero.
And that's all from us in Montreal. A big thank you to the One Young World organizers, to TKNL for their technical help, and to our fantastic panelists, Farkunda, Justin, Sarah, and Aram. We leave you and our audience with some advice from our BBC correspondents as you go forth into the world to make change. How best to get your message across to a global audience?
If I had a piece of advice to you all in dealing with us pesky journalists, it would be answer questions directly. We journos get frustrated when politicians dance around the questions and say what they want to say. If you don't know an answer, just say so. Don't treat an interview as a chance to trot out the easy, prepared lines. Engage with us, and we will with you.
If I had any advice for world leaders, it would be try to be interviewed by independent journalists, journalists perhaps that you know and trust. In my profession, we say that the questions can be as important as the answers. And the questions that we ask will tell you a lot about what the people you work with, the people who have voted for you, believe are the questions that need asking.
Don't ask for the questions in advance. No one likes prepared answers. And listen and answer the question that is being posed. Don't just try and squeeze in your own talking points. And if possible, I guess, relax.
Answer the question. Don't just say whatever it is you want to say anyway. Listen to the question and answer it. Don't use acronyms, even if you think they're really obvious ones and everyone you know knows them. There's a good chance that not everybody does know what you mean. And finally, keep your sentences short if you can. When I tell a story on the TV or on the radio, I have about 3 minutes to tell the whole story. And what I use from you is going to be a little bit of that 3 minutes. So what I'm listening for is something really punchy and to the point and brief.
My advice for answering journalists' questions is to take a moment and think about your answer. It's okay to make us wait.
Be honest. Say what you really think. It's the truth that sets us free.
If you want to get in touch, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X. We are at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Siobhan Leahy and Jacob Evans. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Holly Gibbs. Au revoir.